Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. New Hampshire is here. The process is starting right now. And later on today, we will of course have full coverage of the results. We do have an idea of how one part of it is going to go. In terms of Joe Biden's chances, he is not going to be there. He's apparently going to South Carolina. As I was saying to Edwin before the show, New Hampshire, you can't fire Biden, he quits. He's just going away, he's not doing it. And I look forward to him soon going from South Carolina to Nevada in advance of that one as well. But anyway, look, on today we got a lot to get to. We've got author Robert Frank is gonna come on and talk about his book Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work, hoping to learn a lot there. We've got Michael Bloomberg fighting with Donald Trump about stop and frisk. Those are the two for some reason talking about it, and they both look terrible coming out of it. But also importantly, we have a big interview with author and host Tom Hartman. He is coming on to talk about his book. It is The Hidden History of the War on Voting. He'd previously been on for his book on the Supreme Court. Now we're talking about voter suppression, the history of it, but the current state as well. So stick around, that's gonna be in the next block, a big interview, very interesting book. But before we get to all that, I mean, come on, we gotta talk about Chuck Todd, people. Last night, Chuck Todd launched an attack against Bernie Sanders supporters that, like, you could not do it against the supporters of any other candidate. But you know what? Just in case you haven't seen it, here it is.
Hey, I wanna bring up something that Jonathan Last put in the Bulwark today, and it was about how, and Ruth, we've all been on the receiving end of the Bernie online brigade. And here's what he says. He says, no other candidate has anything like this sort of digital brown shirt brigade. I mean, except for Donald Trump. The question no one is asking is this. What if you can't win the presidency without an online mob? What if we now live in a world where having a bullying aggro social media army running around, popping anyone who sticks their head up is either an important ingredient for or a critical marker of success.
Okay, wow. Okay, that's
I know everybody's freaking out about this, but you saw the MAGA rally that's preparing around here. There are people coming from three or four states on that. That's real, and you know, this is like burning.
That is a really depressing sentence that you just read.
Yeah, I agree with her. That was a really depressing is not the biggest issue. I would say insane is up there, like deeply offensive, anti-Semitic, I would probably throw up there too. So this author, Jonathan Last, writes this article where the supporters of a Jewish American presidential candidate who himself lost family members in the Holocaust, those supporters are Nazis. They're a militia that got Nazis into power. That's how we're going to compare. And the thing is, I know some Chuck Todd defenders might say, well, Chuck Todd's not saying it, it's Jonathan Last that's saying it. Noted and dismissed, because first of all, he chose to take that Jonathan Last article and talk about it. Never once did he disagree with Jonathan Last about that characterization. He never even gave like sort of a sort of wishy-washy, well, you know, I don't like the terminology, it's a bit extremist, but maybe there's something there. He just cited it and then moved on. And then at the end, he chose to compare Trump rallies to Bernie Sanders rallies and said that they're the same. Yes, there's a lot of people at both. It's possible that there are more substantive differences between those if you know someone who's an actual journalist cared to find out, maybe talk to them, maybe try to understand the movement a little bit. Chuck Todd has no interest in that. He just smeared the front runner's supporters as Nazi instigators. And he's perfectly fine. I haven't heard anything from MSNBC that he's in trouble. I haven't seen any sort of retraction, any sort of apology. Importantly, the next big debate before the Nevada caucuses, you know who's gonna be a moderator? Chuck Todd, the guy who thinks that the front runner supporters are Nazis, is going to be asking questions of Bernie Sanders. He's going to be choosing, what are we gonna focus on? I mean, you saw in the last debate where Chuck Todd wasn't even there, the first 15 minutes of the debate were, everyone tell me why Bernie Sanders can't possibly win, and in fact, why having a Democratic Socialist as the nominee will tank every Democrat's chances. That was without the Bernie Sanders bros are Nazis guy. But Chuck Todd is going to be there. Imagine, could you do this to the supporters of any other candidate? And by the way, I wanna sort of complete the loop here. Because they start off, and if you watch the full video, even before that, they're talking about, they bring on the guy who thinks it's unfair to call Michael Bloomberg an oligarch. And he says, look, we've all been on the receiving end of the Bernie bros. They're always mad. Why are they always so mad? Why do they lash out at people? Oh, by the way, they're Nazis. Maybe there's a link there. Maybe the fact that you so callously and anti-Semitically attack the supporters on a daily basis, never once try to understand them. There's no devil's advocate, there's nothing like that. Maybe that's why they're so pissed off. Maybe there's a feeling that you guys aren't fundamentally being fair. And maybe we think as outsiders that it's a little bit weird that on the liberal network, the assumption for everyone on the panel is that obviously it's a bad thing if Bernie Sanders were to win. Let's discuss the various ways it's a bad thing. Don't you think maybe Chuck Todd and the rest of the people on the panel, that that's maybe why a little bit of that anger is there, a little bit of that frustration and suspicion is there? But that's not it, okay? I wanna show you two more clips that really clinch it. So here they move on. What if Bernie Sanders were to sort of win?
This is a part of the campaign that we never had to worry about 4 years ago.
Yeah, and I think the question becomes, what if we get to the convention and Bernie Sanders does not have anywhere near a majority, but he has a plurality. He has 37% of the delegates, and he goes to the convention and says, I won more primaries than anyone else. I have more delegates than anyone else. I dare you to deny me the nomination.
That's exactly
superdelegates.
What I was talking about. Right, you don't have superdelegates anymore. I mean,
on the first ballot.
On the first ballot. At least yeah. On the first ballot. You don't have the members of Congress who would be the elders. I mean, that was exactly the reform that the Bernie Sanders people demanded.
So do you get what just happened there? Like, I can't speak for the journalist necessarily. He's sort of describing a situation that could come about. But was that Andrea Mitchell and Chuck Todd? Instantly, the assumption is, and thus, how would they stop him? Obviously, they have to stop him. It would be a disaster if they didn't stop him, but how would they? I mean, they don't have the superdelegates. And Chuck Todd jumps in and says, no, just on the first vote. They're still there. And then she says, well, we don't have the elders in the room. Just assuming that we should have elders in the room to correct the situation. This horrible, unthinkable situation that would come about if Bernie Sanders received the most votes. And so again, maybe you should try to understand a bit of why we're so frustrated that the assumption of every one of the responsible newsy people on that panel is, of course it's a bad thing if he were to win. But they don't get it. Even when they go to comical lengths to disregard Bernie Sanders. Look, the video quality in this is gonna be absolute dog stuff, but take a look at this.
The real thing that I'm looking for tonight is, of course, that key third place finish, which we were just talking about there in the break. Amy Klobuchar, the momentum is on her side. This would be a huge, huge victory for Amy. In fact, I would almost argue that a third place finish for Amy would be stronger and more important than a first place finish for Bernie.
Okay, you're arguing that. Why would you argue that? That's crazy. Now that's a different show on MSNBC. But what you just saw there was, and they literally, so first she sketches out how getting third place for Amy Klobuchar is more important than that stupid first place, who cares about that? Third place is where it's at. But then she literally says it's more important. You remember all that talk you've heard earlier in this season, and indeed in every Democratic primary, is there's two tickets, maybe three out of Iowa, but no one has ever won who didn't win those states. Now, we are miles away from that. Now, third place is actually where you wanna be. First place, second place, that's where losers dwell, okay? Third place is the best. You wanna be Amy Klobuchar. You wanna get third in New Hampshire, have no map in sight after that. No strategy, no money to get a strategy going on. She's got nothing in plans for Nevada, South Carolina, no chance on Super Tuesday. But no, that's the important thing. Let's not even talk about who's in first. First. What are we primitives? What are we, savages, to talk about first? It's absurd the lengths that they go to disregard him. And then when they choose to focus on him, you sort of pine for the times when they disregarded him, because at least then they're not calling his supporters Nazis. That's the rock and the hard place that the liberal news network puts us in. Okay, stick around, Tom Hartman after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies. debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
America, technically a democracy. And one of the collective fantasies we have in our American democracy is that everybody supports democracy. They support voting. They want everyone to be involved. We like to believe that that's true. But in 100 different ways, some of them very obvious, some of them more hidden, that's not the case. And there are a lot of people and groups working behind the scenes to make it as hard as possible for you to vote. Much of that and even more is explored in the now released The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote, and How to Get It Back. And we're joined now by the author and host of the Tom Hartmann Program. Tom Hartmann, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, John, it's great to see you again.
Great to have you here. I will say before we dive into your book, I don't know how you get this much writing done.
Four or five hours of the day every day and books come out.
Okay, well, it works for you. And you know, we always enjoy them. And so I really want to dive into this material. Obviously, you want people to read the book. You're not going to expose everything. But tell us a little bit about this hidden history. What are some of the forms that it's taken?
Well, the Republican Party has been all about suppressing the vote for a long, long time. I mean, the suppression of the vote has a long history in the United States. Obviously, slavery was an institution that suppressed the vote. Women didn't have the right to vote until around 1920. African Americans technically got the right to vote after the Civil War, but that really didn't happen until the 1960s. And even to this day, now the Republican Party, prior to the 1960s, it was the Democratic Party, has been aggressively suppressing the African American vote and the Hispanic vote. And of course, the Native American vote to this day is still also being suppressed. But the Republican Party in particular was in absolute shambles right after the Nixon resignation. And they were just like, you know, what do we do now? I mean, there literally was a conversation about whether it was going to go the way of the Whigs. And then when in 1976, Jerry Ford lost to Jimmy Carter, that convinced the higher up figures in the Republican Party that they had to do something different. And coincidentally, in 1976, the Supreme Court, which I covered this in my previous book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. In 76, a Supreme Court decision called Buckley versus Vallejo, the Supreme Court ruled that if a billionaire wanted to own a politician or even a number of politicians, put so much money in that basically they would not be in office without that person. And that person had specific things that they would like from that politician. We used to call that bribery, or at the very least corruption. In 76, the Supreme Court ruled that that was actually First Amendment protected free speech, using money to buy political power. And then 2 years later, in a decision called First National Bank versus Bilotti, the Supreme Court extended that logic to corporations. And this led in 79 to a ton of corporate money and billionaire money coming in to elect Ronald Reagan in 1980. And they've been off to the races ever since then. But it really, the need for more than just money became very evident to the Republican Party in 92 when Bill Clinton beat George Herbert Walker Bush. even though they were pouring enormous amounts of money into the campaign, Clinton had kind of gotten around them by taking his own corporate money. You know, this was the whole deal that he and Al Fromm worked out the year before, 1991, with, you know, the Democratic Leadership Council. So the Republicans were like back to square one. Okay, we've got to figure out another way to win elections. And saying to people, hey, we're the party of the billionaires and the corporations, wasn't gonna do it. They had pulled together a coalition of basically racists and paranoids and gun nuts and whatnot. But even that really wasn't enough to consistently win elections or to hold national power. So in particular with the election of 2000, they started an aggressive, they went back to their roots, back to the 60s. William Rehnquist actually made his chops in the Republican Party, the guy who was Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice in the 2000 Bush v. Gore decision, who ruled that there is no right to vote for president in the Constitution. Verbatim quote from that decision. Rehnquist made his chops in the 60s in Arizona. He's a big burly guy. He's like 6'2 and, you know, 250, 280, something like that. By going to Hispanic and Native American polling places and standing next to the line and challenging every single voter and making them jump through all kinds of hoops and slowing down the lines and scaring people away, frankly. That got him ultimately to the chief justiceship. But so voter suppression is a long story in the Republican Party. But in the 2000 election, Jeb Bush, the brother of the candidate, George W. Bush, ordered Catherine Harris, his Secretary of State, to knock between 30 and 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls by using a list of Texas felons. The African American name pool is much smaller in the United States than is the Caucasian name pool. The same is true of the Hispanic name pool and the Asian name pool. They're all much smaller than the Caucasian name pool, which derives from, you know, dozens of different languages, Greek and Norwegian and German and French and Spanish. And so as a result, if you take a felon list from Texas, where over half the felons are black, and you compare that with a voter list in Florida, looking for people who are double voting in both states, you'll find a lot of people who have very similar names, and they were only looking for similar. So John Johnson in Texas and J.J. Johnson in Florida, or John Q. Johnson in Texas and John L. Johnson in Florida, they consider that a match. And so they threw all these African-American off the voting rolls, and that got the election within a few hundred votes that George W. Bush could steal it. Although we did learn a year later that Bush actually lost that election when the New York Times actually counted the ballots. It's just that they buried that in paragraph 17 of the story because the final 11 attacks, and they didn't want to diminish Bush's, you know, credibility.
Yeah.
So that produced the first redshift. And, you know, we can get into redshift if you'd like. That was the beginning. And then the Help America Vote Act in 2002 gave them a whole new weapon called a provisional ballot.
So I do want to get into that. I do have a more general question, something that's always frustrated me about this. You correctly trace back that, you know, since we've had a country, it's been baked into our constitution, and it continues up to this day. New innovative ways to try to reduce the number of people from voting as much as possible. My question is, why doesn't it seem to matter? Why doesn't there seem to be any sort of political price to pay for so aggressively fighting against democracy? Why don't, like, the Democrats don't really run on it as a thing? They'll run on a general concept of corruption maybe in one election, but not on a general concept of we are the ones who actually care about American democracy. We're gonna make it easier for you to vote. We're gonna do a voting holiday. We're gonna stop the suppression. Is it just that, like, the American people aren't clued into it? It's something that's always been there. So why doesn't it seem to matter more?
This is a problem within the Democratic Party that they have largely solved. H.R. 1, the first piece of legislation that passed the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi got out, and it's sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk where it'll probably die. Addresses that issue and essentially makes voting a right and cleans up a lot of these problems and forbids a lot of the things that the Republicans are doing right now. But I remember back in 2000, I think it was 2005, a bunch of us who were with Air America at the time, it was me and Randy Rhodes, I don't think Al Franken was there, there were a couple of other hosts though. We went to Washington, D.C. and we met with a group of six or seven Democratic senators. And later that day, we met with a bunch of House members. And we were talking about media generally, but this issue came up, you know, that there had been this massive voter suppression in the 2002 election, in the 2004 election. Why are you guys not yelling about it? And in particular, at that point in time, we thought that Redshift was being caused by voting machines being hacked. Mm-hmm. And so we were like, why are you guys not yelling about voting machines? And one of the Democratic senators, a member of the leadership, of the senior leadership of the Democratic Party in the Senate, not Chuck Schumer, but another senator, made the comment to us that they were concerned about bringing this topic up because they were afraid that if people thought that they couldn't trust that their vote would be counted, that they wouldn't show up, they wouldn't vote. And they didn't want to do anything to discourage people from showing up and voting. So they were essentially trying to ignore the issue. And you know, that was pretty much the party's position right up until about 4 years ago.
Wow. And well, thankfully, four years ago, Republicans stopped doing this. They're not interested in suppressing the vote anymore. Yeah. So it was a strategy that worked out just fine. Based on your historical analysis and your current read of some of the efforts to fight back against this, you point to things like HR1. There's groups like Stacey Abrams and things like that. Are you pretty satisfied with HR1? Are there other efforts either at the federal level or that activists are engaged in that you think we should be focusing more on to try to fight back against this?
Well, HR1 is a really, really solid, good beginning. And then there's another piece of legislation, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the bill number, but it also passed, which was a little more modest version that they thought would be Republican acceptable. That also is sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk. Really, though, what we need to do is assert that voting is a right. As Rehnquist pointed out in the Bush v. Gore decision, where George Bush sued to stop the recount in Florida because if it continued, it would, quote, cause irreparable harm to complainant George W. Bush, end quote. which was actually.
We don't want that.
I mean. Right. But as Rehnquist pointed out, there is no right to vote in the Constitution. And the reason why there's not a right to vote in the Constitution is because so many people were excluded from voting at the time the Constitution was written. And, as I pointed out earlier, women didn't even get the vote until 1920. So what we need is a constitutional amendment at the best, or a very specific piece of legislation at the very least, that explicitly says that voting in the United States is a right, not a privilege. Mm-hmm. And what that would do is it would flip the burden of proof, essentially. Right now, if you live in a state with a Republican Secretary of State, the odds are reasonably good, particularly if you live in a city or you live near an area that has a large African American population, a large student population, or a large elderly population, that your name will be removed from the voting rolls, particularly if you didn't vote in the last election. They'll say, oh, he's moved, and they'll take your name off the rolls. And when you show up to vote, they'll give you a provisional ballot. I call them placebo ballots, which is never counted unless the election is contested. And even then, your vote won't be counted unless you've gone to the Secretary of State's office to prove that you were actually legitimately voting.
Wow.
So, the consequence of this, or how to say it, the solution to this is if it were in law that we have a right to vote, then instead of my having to prove to the Secretary of State that I'm a legitimate voter in the state would have to prove to me that I'm no longer a legitimate voter in the state. The burden of proof would shift. And it would make all of these, or not all, but the vast majority of these Republican games stop. Mm.
Yeah, and it seems like the sort of amendment that how could you stand against it, although I'm sure that Sean Hannity would find a way, and Mitch McConnell. So I want to tantalize people about the book a little bit, and so I want to talk just briefly. We don't have to spoil the whole thing, but one of the areas that you get into that I don't hear a lot of talk about, especially from the left, is about the possibility of adding additional states. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why you think that's a direction we should move in?
Yeah, first of all, there's a long precedent for this, John. Back right after the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was concerned that as the Southern states reconstructed their constitutions and came back into the Union, that they may end up with a majority of the Senate. and which would be a disaster for the Republicans. And so at that time, it took, as I recall, 34,000, the number's in the book, but it was in that neighborhood, 34,000 people in a territory to qualify to be a state. That was the minimum number for one member of the House of Representatives. And Nevada only had, as I recall, around 14 or 16,000 people in it, or at least, you know, white citizens. And but Abraham Lincoln reached out to Nevada and made them a state anyway, just to get two more senators. And then after Andrew Johnson left office in 1869 and Ulysses S. Grant came in as president, he was facing the same thing. Again, the southern states were coming back into the Union and they were concerned about holding a Republican majority in the Senate. And so the Dakota Territory, which was one territory at the time and had fewer than 40,000 people in what became both states. In fact, I believe it was fewer than 30,000 people. He declared that the Dakota Territory would become two states, North Dakota and South Dakota, and each state would have two senators. And so the Republican Party got six senators over about a 15-year period by simply adding states. And that held the Republican majority in the Senate for a long, long time. We could do sort of the same thing right now by simply having the District of Columbia, which at over a million people has more people than Wyoming or Vermont or, you know, some other states, having them become a state and having Puerto Rico become a state. Mm.
And in both cases, there have been groups that have been working towards that. So it's not some, you know, oddball idea. It's actually based in a lot of effort that's been done over the years. So very interesting. As always, you know, we're glad to have you on. You write fascinating books, and everybody always says, like, about books that are concerned with history, that it has lessons for today. But this, all it has is lessons for today. Like, we're still engaged in so many of these fights, and I'm always glad to see people focusing on the issue of voting rights and democracy. And so, Tom, as always, thank you.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be on your program. Thank you so much.
Thank
for the
you. And I want to plug the book one more time, if we could bring it up. It is The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote, and How to Get It Back, available now by author Tom Hartman. And we're going to take a short break, but we'll be back with more right after this. The biggest issues for Michael Bloomberg is his passionate advocacy for stop and frisk. I mean, he fought for it harder than I've probably ever fought for anything in my life. Although oddly, he doesn't mention it in any of his ads which are running all over the country right now. Some are probably running on this video you're watching. But look, the things that he said about this policy, which obviously was designed and indeed did, was incredibly inequitable in who it targeted. It was a horrible, horrible racist policy. Is that more and more of the quotes of him defending it are coming out. So I want you to take a look at this defense from Michael Bloomberg from back in the day.
95% of your murders and murderers and murder victims fit one MO. You can just take the description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops. They are male minorities, 15 to 25. That's true in New York, it's true in virtually every city. And that's where the real crime is. You've got to get the guns out of the hands of the people that get killed. She's going to be wanting to spend the money for a lot of cops in the street, put those cops where the crime is, which means in the minority neighborhood. So this is one of the unintended consequences is people say, oh my God, you are arresting kids for marijuana. They're all minorities. Yes, that's true. Why? Because we put all the cops in the minority neighborhoods. Yes, that's true. Why we do it? Because that's where all the crime is. And the way she got the guns out of her kids' hands is to throw them against the wall and frisk them. And then they start, they say, oh, I don't want that, I don't want to get caught, so they don't bring the gun. They still have a gun, but they leave it at home.
Okay, so there are at least three levels as to why this is just terrible. So the first is, objectively,
it's a racist policy driven by a racist view of the world, and it had racist outcomes, horrific outcomes for black and brown people in the areas that he could put it in place. And presumably in the future, if he had power over more areas, it would then be in those places as well. So that's first level. Second level, inside the Democratic primary, he hasn't had to engage with the process at all, except through his ads so far. But he's going to be on the next debate stage more than likely, and I expect it is going to be a very rough time for him when he has to finally answer for what he has said and done. So that's the primary. Looking forward to the general election, how do you feel about going up against Donald Trump with a guy like Mike Bloomberg, whose history is littered with quotes like that? So that was unearthed by Benjamin P. Dixon, credit to him for that. I found in interviews similar sort of comments about him responding to it being struck down as unconstitutional, stop and frisk, and him saying, no, this is totally fine, it doesn't matter. In fact, he said, well, we'll get to more quotes from him, but that's who you would have going up against Donald Trump, who is himself a racist, but Donald Trump is already jumping on this thing. Take a look at this tweet that Trump initially put out today. It's on that video, the Benjamin Dixon video, and he says, in full caps, wow, Bloomberg is a total racist. And why does he do that? Because he's concerned about the negative impact on these individuals in New York. No, he doesn't care about that at all, but he does want to win an election. And so if you have Mike Bloomberg up against Trump, Trump is going to hammer into him, this guy is a racist, racism, stop and frisk, racist policies, racist. Even though Trump said this.
Well, one of the things I'd do, Ricardo, is I would do stop and frisk. I think you have to. We did it in New York, it worked incredibly well, and you have to be proactive. And you know, you really help people sort of change their mind automatically. You understand. You have to have, in my opinion, I see what's going on here, I see what's going on in Chicago. I think stop and frisk. In New York City, it was so incredible the way it worked. Now we had a very good mayor, but New York City was incredible the way that worked. So I think that would be one step you could do.
Okay, so yes, it's funny that he's like Michael Bloomberg, very good mayor, but then stop and frisk, dude, it was great the way it worked out. Like, it didn't negatively impact me in any way, so I guess it must have been great. It's awesome, it was great there, I'd like to see it in other areas. So that was back in 2016. You know, years later, he told an audience of police chiefs in Chicago, this is as president, so they should strongly consider stop and frisk. It works, and it was meant for problems like Chicago. So yeah, no, he's been pushing even as president for nationwide stop and frisk. Now I'm not in any way saying that his support for stop and frisk makes Bloomberg look any better. Indeed, I'm saying the opposite. They're both terrible, they both support this wildly, inherently racist policy. And so imagine, you have an opportunity to distinguish yourself against Donald Trump, horrific liar, horrific racist, and you're gonna choose a guy who for years after it was struck down was still arguing for why stop and frisk was awesome, only begrudgingly a couple of months ago sort of apologized for it. But bear in mind that for a long time he was saying things like this. So you know, like we found out, like 97% of the people that they're stopping are non-white, which is obviously wildly discriminatory. He didn't think so. He said, I think we disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little. It's exactly the reverse of what they say. He not only pushed for it, got it, like presided over it, but after it was struck down, that was the hill he wanted to die on. Now, Trump is an obvious hypocrite, an obvious liar on this issue, and a racist to boot, but he will use this against Mike Bloomberg. How about we don't give him the chance? How about we don't get to that point where you have two racists going up against each other in the general election? How about we rightfully make this an issue in this primary? And on that debate stage, in not too long, when Mike Bloomberg is finally there and he has to face actual voters and actual competitors in the race, I wanna see them drill him on this issue. It is well deserved. Okay, stick around, more after this. For a long time, trying to figure out how do we convince people of the threat posed by climate change, but more importantly, beyond that, how do we actually push people to make the right changes? Regular people, but also those with actual power over national policy. Well, joining us right now is an author with a few ideas on that area, Robert H. Frank, author of Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
Very glad to have you here. So peer pressure and climate change. What's the connection between those two things?
The reason we emit energy in the ways we do and build big houses and drive heavy cars is not so much that we don't pay the right prices for those things. That's part of the problem, to be sure. Mainly, we do those things because other people like us do them. And that's the surest route to get us to change our behavior is to nudge other people to start changing too.
So in these areas like the size of homes, the size and power of cars and things like that, we have seen a sort of arms race where people are not necessarily getting what they need or even a little bit beyond what they need. But because they're surrounded in a context where people are consuming more and more and bigger, that's driving a lot of really significant economic activity, correct?
Others buy bigger cars. That puts us at greater risk of injury and death. So we respond rationally by buying bigger too. Then they build bigger and we build bigger and it continues. And when everybody's got a 7,000-pound vehicle, the risk of injury and death goes up, not down, compared to when we're all driving smaller cars. It would be easy to switch back to the old way, but we need a signal to get us to do that.
Okay, so I think a lot of people can, they hear that and they understand that. In the area of fighting climate change, if we want to change people's behavior, how can we harness this sort of effect?
You know, we saw how to do it in the case of smoking. Smoking causes harm to others. The real reason it makes sense to tax it and discourage it is to prevent people from causing that harm to others. The greatest harm you cause if you become a smoker is to make others more likely to smoke. We never offered that as a reason. We said that we needed to regulate smoking to prevent others from being harmed by secondhand smoke. But the real harm you do is to make others more likely to smoke. And it's the same with building bigger houses and driving bigger cars. The real reason you cause harm when you do that is you make other people more likely to follow suit. And so simple changes in policy could get us to reverse those trends. And it would be much easier also to raise the prodigious sums we need in order to invest in a green energy economy. All that would be much easier than people realize just because there's such tremendous leverage in peer effects.
You know, so obviously we're going to turn to the big efforts that the government can take. Staying on consumer choice for a second, though, I know that some people see, like for instance, people talking about owning electric cars. They don't necessarily want to hear electric car like evangelism. Like if somebody talks about veganism, like Joaquin Phoenix had his big speech at the Oscars where he was talking about animal agriculture, which is obviously a big part of global carbon emissions. And they say that no, you're turning people off by talking about it. There's all these commercials now of these plant-based products. Do they have it wrong? Are those sorts of like public advocacy things actually a normalizing influence?
You know, John, as an economist, I was pretty much in that same critic's boat. I thought individual, responsible, low carbon footprint actions by themselves were a distraction at best and maybe even worse than that, if they kept you from focusing on the really big policy changes that we need to adopt. But studying behavioral contagion has completely changed my mind about that. Taking those small steps has a much bigger impact than you ever would imagine. Buying a hybrid car, for example, induces other people to think about buying one. You don't have to preach about it. Everybody likes to be seen as being environmentally responsible. And if you see your neighbor driving a hybrid car, that makes you more likely to consider one. And if you then buy one, that makes someone else more likely also. The same with food choices. We have enormous contagion in our dietary choices as the fad diet craze well attests. So when people change their diets, it makes others more likely to do that too. The main effect, though, of these individual actions is that they change who you are. They build a new identity for you as a climate advocate. And when that happens, you really do become much more likely to support the politicians who would take the robust policy measures that we need to take if we're to have any hope of solving the problem.
You know, in the book, you talk about this idea over sacrifices that individuals might have to take, how painful they might be. And you write that this belief that there won't need to be painful sacrifices is linked to a concept you call the mother of all cognitive illusions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the reason it's been hard to get support for the important and large investments we need to make to create a green economy is that people imagine that if they had to pay much more in taxes to support those investments, it would require painful sacrifices of them. Nobody's proposing to tax wealthy people so much that they can't afford to buy what they need. That's not on the table at all. What they seem worried about is that they won't be able to afford the special extras that they want, maybe a penthouse apartment with a sweeping view of the city. But special extras, by their nature, are just a relative concept. They're in short supply. There are only so many of them. How do you get them? You have to outbid people like yourself who also want them. And here's the key. When your taxes go up and their taxes go up, everyone's bidding power for those special extras remains exactly the same as before. So the same scarce penthouse apartments with sweeping views end up in the same hands as they would have before the tax increase. Nobody needs to make any painful sacrifices at all.
You know, it's fascinating. But there's one other area I was interested in. We saw a Q&A that you had done about the book, and you were responding to some of the critiques of one of the big legislative pushes concerning climate change right now, which is the Green New Deal, which has sort of a holistic view of the climate crisis, but connected with a number of other issues. And that is often what is attacked when people attack the Green New Deal. Can you tell us a little bit about your response to those critiques of the Green New Deal?
Yeah, it's interesting, John. The critics, many of them on the left, say that, oh, that's too ambitious. If you tackle inequality and climate all at once, you'll just ensure failure in both domains. But if you look at the policies we would need to adopt to attack either one of those problems alone, you'll see immediately that the policies are deeply synergistic. We would need to raise a lot of money from high-income voters if we're to finance the green investments we need to make to have a renewable energy economy. The very fact of taxing those high-income voters would generate the revenue needed to pay for those investments, but it would also have a second effect. It would reduce the extreme income differences between people at the top and everyone else. So there's not only not a conflict between the two approaches, if we don't do both of them at once, neither one of them is likely to succeed.
I obviously could not agree more. The book is Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Robert H. Frank, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We really do appreciate it. And for those of you at home, we have just a little bit more. We'll see you on the other side. Hello all and welcome back to what remains of the Damage Report. We did go over on a few of our blocks, so we're just about out of time, but I did want to let you know, I will be on the main show with Cenk Uygur for both hours later on today on the main Young Turk show. And there will of course be an entire day effectively of New Hampshire coverage. Before we get to all that, I did want to thank you all for leaving your reviews of the podcast on iTunes. As I always say, it is crucial for more people actually being exposed to it, the way the algorithm works. So I wanted to thank Meadow O for leaving a review saying, I've been a fan of TYT and the main show for a long time. Having the Damage Report 2 is amazing. John is great and always a pleasure to listen to. Well, you are also a pleasure to read. So thank you, Meadow O. And Steve D said, out of all the regular TYT hosts, John is definitely my favorite. And I'm so happy that he was able to get his own show. The wide variety of topics and guests mixed with John's personable reporting style really helped keep the show exciting and fun to listen to. I also appreciate his continued focus on important international subjects, particularly climate change. Additionally, I feel like I have to mention how awesome the transition music is between ads and segments. So that is Bart. I don't get any credit for that, but Bart, thank you for the great music. It is being recognized. And thank you to everybody who's left those reviews and left a 5-star review. We're closing in on 2,000, which I would love to get to. Oh, also, We're gonna be trying to do a little bit more sort of like back and forth with people watching the show. So we don't have any sort of notice or anything yet, but there is a hashtag, hashtag TDR live, like TYT live, that you can tweet at us. And I'm gonna try to read it periodically throughout the show. So if you have a question or a comment about something that we're talking about or something that you see in the news that we might not notice, I'll be trying to pay attention to that too. I did want to give you one fast little bit of breaking news. I know a lot of people have been really worried about the spread of the coronavirus. It's killed a lot of people, but our president believes that he has the solution. He says that it will die out when it gets hot, that heat kills viruses. And so, you know, by like April, we should be good. So that's what I'm gonna leave you with. See you tomorrow on JR Wednesdays.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.